When breakfast was over, the king stepped around the table and bent to kiss his wife's cheek. This assertion of ownership, the queen endured like stone. Costas was transfixed. He struggled to imagine her own mother kissing the queen and balked, seeing instead an adult Atolia somehow shrunk to the size of a child. Distracted by the image, he was late to realize that everyone on the terrace was looking at him.
That is the face of a man who thought things couldn't get any weirder 15 pages ago.
Welcome back, I'm Noelle.
And I'm Caitlin.
And this is the Atolian Archives, your Queen's Thief reread podcast to get you through the wait for Return of the Thief, which is in only 310 days. It's October 20th, 2019.
We've got a lot to cover in this episode. Chapter 3 is a long one.
30 action-packed pages featuring a bunch of guys standing in a line, multiple notable breakfast failures, friendship, sparring, sort of, lessons on olive production and the mead language, a court session slash nap, a shadowy exchange between Talaeus and Relius, clashy yellow outfits, and Costas astral projecting out of his body every time he turns a corner.
So, right off the bat, Costas wakes up and Talaeus makes every person in the guard, all that 1,000 and however many of them.
How big is this? They're in like a courtyard?
Yeah. So it's got to be some huge courtyard. It says over 1,000 men were standing there.
I can't wrap my head around that space.
It's too big for me to picture.
The scale of that space.
I don't know. But also, this is so interesting. Like, it's a palace guard. They're only guarding the palace and, like, the queen inside it. So, like, how many people, how many guards are on duty at one time? Like,
how many could you possibly need? No wonder
hundred?
Jen wants to cut it in half.
What can you possibly do with 1,000 for one? I mean, I get it's an enormous building, okay, but, like,
that's so many guys who need so much yogurt. And in the next chapter, Eugenides is going to make a comment about how they're mostly decorative.
Mm-hmm.
They just stand there. They just stand around. That's their job, which is what they do today.
But, like, could 200 people be on duty at the same time? 400? It doesn't make sense to have 800 off duty at any one given time. What are the numbers?
Yeah, some of them have to be standing guard at particular places.
Oh, wait.
Some of them have to be doing training. I'm sure that they do continuous training, professional development for the palace guard.
Yeah, but also this is the guard for around the clock. So
Yes. If
we say, like, maybe 8-hour watches are the norm, that's like 300 people every 8 hours. All right, that makes it a little more reasonable when you think of it like that.
The numbers still a lot of guys.
Like, yeah.
It's a lot of toy soldiers. You understand even more Costas's horror at being called out.
Yeah.
I just picture this huge, huge crowd of guys lined up, and Costas has to step out of the line, and he has to walk up to Talaeus, and the silence of that moment.
Yeah.
I wanna say, please give Costas a break, and it's only chapter 3.
It's mentioned that there are squad leaders, and there are centurions, and there are lieutenants. So I think somewhere else it mentions that there's 10 men in a squad, but I'm not sure about that. So if we think of...
That makes sense. 10 men in a squad, 10 squads in a centurion.
So that's... How many squads is that? 100 squads for 1,000 people.
Yes.
I can't do math, guys.
10 men in a squad, 10 squads in a century, 10 centuries.
Okay. And an unspecified amount of lieutenants.
Yes, because they're not in the squads. There's a lot of guys.
That's why they say over 1,000, probably.
This palace is just chock full of boys. Soldiers own their swords, but guns belong to the queen, which is interesting.
Mm.
There's something very traditional about the personal sword, but a gun is like a new technology.
Yeah. And Jen said in The Thief, when he was being chased by guards with guns, that the queen had her own guard carry guns because she thought it made them more impressive, even though
the
guns
aren't
very
that
accurate.
Useful. The sword is what matters.
Mm.
Like, that's... who would even want to own a gun?
Right.
It's an extravagance.
Mm-hmm.
So Tullius gives Costas and then everybody the chance to leave their post, leave their rank, leave the castle, forsake their oath without penalty, and then leaves them standing there all day to think about it. And nobody leaves. And I wanted to ask you why you think that is, that mm-hmm. not a single man leaves.
I think it's because... So they are all loyal to the queen, even though the king is now in the picture. His presence there doesn't make them any less loyal to the queen. But also, I mean, these people must have a financial incentive to stay, too. Like, it's mentioned that... I mean, we've talked about this in the past, too, that some people from lower in society are able to go higher through the guard.
Yeah.
And have opportunities that they did not have before.
Yeah. They're either from non-landowning families or they're from landowning families, but they're like a second son.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a phrase while they're being left out all day to bake, when time is passing, it says, "The trumpets had blown for the end of bird watch and the beginning of bat." And I have no idea what those terms mean. It has something to do with the way that they break up the day.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's something that Megan Whelan-Turner made up or if that actually has to do with something that Roman
is that a
soldiers
real military
did. It's very hard to Google those. If you know, if you Google birdwatch, you're going to get birds.
We also get more about class issues in this chapter. Costas is horrified that Aris delivered the message that had hunting hounds released into the courtyard as the king walked by, because Sejanus, that guy told Aris to deliver it. Costas is saying, why didn't you refuse to deliver it? Like, why didn't that cross your mind? And Aris says, well, of course it would have crossed yours, Costas, because you're not an Oakloy.
Yeah, you want to know who asked me to deliver the message? The second son of the man my father pays his taxes to.
Mm-hmm.
So he must be on the Arendides land.
Mm-hmm. And so even though they do have this nominal equality, both as squad leaders and the guard, in reality, their positions are still very different because of where they do come from. Like,
yeah.
Aris has less security than Costas does.
It doesn't occur to Costas that that would be a factor
for
Aris. And Aris says that you would have said no and damn the consequences because you have a sense of honor as wide as a river. I'm sure that Costas's honor and his shoulders are both as wide as a river.
There's another part in this chapter where Aris said that the squad leaders who came to eat lunch with Costas to say that they support him. Aris says, they like you, they respect you. Costas asks why, unaware that he might be admirable in any way. Aris put his head in his hands, an image of despair at such naivety. That, Costas, is the difference between you and, say, someone like Lieutenant Enkelis. You didn't think you deserved to be promoted after Thegmus. He wants to be captain someday, so he makes sure he's better than anyone else. You just want to be better. And that's why everyone thought you'd make Centurion and Lieutenant and maybe captain someday. They wanted you to be captain. They'll never want Enkelis.
This chapter is just a line of people facepalming at each other.
And this is nice because it really sets up our image of Costas very early as someone who is morally upright, who was respected before this little dip.
If you're gonna get punched, you should try and get punched by the best man in the country. He really knows how to pick him. Well, because Jen is a good judge of character.
Yeah, and this is something else that makes me think Jen picked Costas on purpose to be the person mm-hmm. to have next to him to change Delace's mind, because he knew that Costas has already won these people's respect.
Yeah.
So if he can get Costas' good opinion, not only will Tullius change his mind, but also everyone who respects Costas will take that into account.
Mm-hmm. He can't convince people directly. He has to go through an honest person. And then while Costas and Aris are arguing about whether or not Aris should tell Tullius about having delivered the message, Eugenides appears out of nowhere, quote, like an apparition, unquote. One, he's a spooky boy, and I picture him just like popping up from behind a piece of furniture. Well, hello there. And it feels like foreshadowing for both the fact that he can get places without his attendants knowing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know that he's moving around without their knowledge at this point, but he is, mm-hmm. and you see it here. And also, it's foreshadowing for like all the ways in which he like is revealed as this book goes on.
And I think it's so funny that, so first of all, Costas is just totally floored that he could be somewhere without his attendants knowing, which, okay, that's fair. But what I think is funny is that even though this happens in chapter 3, at the very beginning of Costas's acquaintanceship with Jen, for the whole rest of the book, he's like, oh, he could never be doing anything sneaky. Of course he's right in the room next to me, even though, you know, I'm out here and can't see him. But, like, he's already seen the evidence right here.
He literally appears and disappears with no sound of footsteps.
And is miles away from where he's expected to be, right in front of Costas.
And Costas so looks funny. Down the hallway after he turns down the hallway, and he's
gone! He's not there.
What do you think he did? And I remember reading this for the first time, and thinking, you're not going to pull one over on me again, Megan. I'm going to assume that every time he's not in Costas's direct line of vision, he's up to something. And he is. Do you think that Eugenides planned to talk to Karis, which is Costas and Aris combined? That's their ship name, folks. Do you think that he had planned to talk to them, or do you think that he was just going to hide and listen?
I would kind of guess he was going to just hide and listen, and then maybe, you know, he just saw the opportunity and took it.
It feels like he kind of can't resist helping.
And that he's doing this entire book's worth of getting closer to Costas to have Costas know him, and this is a step towards that, of saying, look, I'm not just the fool everyone takes me for, and I can appear out of nowhere. So that's just a tiny bit of the truth of him coming out.
Yeah, I feel like Costas is just so thrown off balance at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Everything feels like, did I die and go to hell? Is this a dream?
Yeah.
That the idea of the king appearing and disappearing is kind of a this might as well happen situation.
Just one more example of the weird.
And other than this moment, Jen spends most of this chapter reinforcing the bumbling persona.
Mm-hmm.
During the sparring with Costas, everybody thinks that Jen hasn't even mastered the basics of sword fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Which you think the information that he is an expert swordsman would be available.
How did that not get there from Edis? Like, he killed an Aetolian soldier like 2-3 years ago before the war. Like, I guess that just did not make it back.
But information is just not available to people.
Yeah.
You can't just go...
You can't go Google.
You can't.
Of Edis.
There is no Aetolian Google. He does not have a Wikipedia page. Because Aetolia would have known that. Her immediate powerful advisors would have known that. But why would that have made it down to a guardsman? Or even Tullius?
Yeah, Tullius does not know. Yeah, because Tullius says... When he's talking to Costas at the end, explaining that he's a lieutenant now, Tullius says, I'd like to think a desire for justice temporarily evicted common sense, but it's hard to justify attacking someone so incapable of defending himself, however contemptible he may be, and, he added, however much your comrades might congratulate you for it.
I know we've said this before, but his hand has been replaced with a knife. It's a knife.
And they do say later, like, oh, the king wears a lot of mead coats with super long sleeves to hide the hook on purpose to trick you. But, like, still. Come on.
Jen's plans work because everyone around him is a complete dumbass.
Yeah. And they don't want to believe he's anything else. You know? They don't want to try and see him as more complex than that. They don't want to have to reckon with what would it mean for him to be a competent person.
Yeah, it's much easier for them mm-hmm. to have this narrative about who he is.
On a related note, something that's puzzled me is Jen has lessons to go to in this chapter on olive production and taxation and then the mead language. So does he actually need them? And if he does, was it his idea or Atolia's idea? Or, like, could this be some sort of extension of this bumbling persona that he, like, doesn't know how to speak mead? He doesn't know anything about taxation? Like, I think that would be kind of far to go.
Yeah. I felt that, I mean, the mead lessons are mead lessons, but I always thought of the agriculture one as more of a briefing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, too.
And he is getting valuable information from
right.
it.
Right. And also, I mean, clearly speaking mead is at some point going to be important. And clearly Costas gets fluent from observing.
Don't cut class. And Jen is pretending to be asleep during the afternoon court.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, he's listening.
Atolia is not amused.
No. Let's talk about Atolia in this chapter.
Yeah.
Because she's very funny, but very dry, very stone-faced. And you looking at her from Costas's perspective is very different than looking at her from Jen's perspective.
Yeah. Costas is terrified. Like, at breakfast with the king, he mentions that his attendants have triumphed today in their quest to make him look foolish and giving him a sash that doesn't match his coat. And she says, "You are unhappy with your attendants." And Costas's skin crawls at the thought of anyone who displeases the queen. Because she's just that scary.
But then she's making fun of Jen. She's saying he orders his clothes in colors that would suit a canary, and at least his father has a sense of dignity. She makes fun of him for sleeping in the court session.
Mm-hmm.
And Costas interprets that as she is, like, lashing out against him in the only way that she can.
Mm-hmm.
But she's teasing him.
Yeah.
Nobody has ever been in a situation to understand that she's funny.
Yeah.
I want to eat all the food. I know what it is about fantasy novels. It's just granola and yogurt and dried fruit and bread and cheese and wine. But I want all of it. I could go to the supermarket and buy that stuff right now, but it wouldn't be the same.
Yeah.
I want to eat it out of a wooden bowl after a day of sparring with my wooden sword.
It helps that Costas is so hungry when he eats it. Like, you can kind of feel that through the narration. He hasn't eaten all day.
Yeah. When he misses his breakfast,
want to eat. Yeah.
I like that pains me.
Yes.
Costas, he's never been in the inner palace before.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, like, most of the people of his rank, he's never been in the inner palace. Which is so wild, but it's a
huge building.
This is a huge building. Or even with, like, a complex of buildings.
Yeah,
would probably be more accurate.
Seven known architects, apparently.
There are so many funny moments. Jen keeps asking Costas to tell him words in mead. And they're like, the conjugation of to hit. The word for traitor. The word for idiot. Are you happy now, buddy? Costas has one friend. Harris is his one friend. I thought about telling Artidorus he needed a haircut. I'd like us to conclude on a quote which I'd forgotten about and is really striking. At the very end of the chapter, Costas is talking to Tullius, and he says, "How can I be a lieutenant, sir?" And Tullius says, "Because you have been promoted by the king's whim, far beyond your merits. If the king succeeds in eliminating me, you might be the next captain of the guard. It's a joke, Costas. You are a joke. If you don't want the king's joke to be a success, then do your duty and do it well. No doubt there are other men he will attempt to destroy. We don't have to make it easy for him." You are a joke. That's harsh and also totally wrong, but maybe a little bit right.
Yeah, I mean, Jen is very used to making fun of people.
And this is, I mean,
Costas does have this coming, or at least a little bit, right?
And this whole, I mean, the entire book is it's a joke that Eugenides plays on everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very different kind of joke than Tullius thinks it is.
Yeah.
It has a different
on
goal.
Different people.
Yeah, it's on different people. I don't know, I just love that.
Yeah. Like, I think one of the reasons that Costas does end up getting closer to Jen is that after this conversation with Tullius, he is taking it seriously.
Yeah, he's trying to do the best he can possibly do.
Yeah,
maybe someone else would have just given up.
Yeah.
Just a straightforward, upstanding young man.
That's chapter 3. Next time, Jen temporarily bests his attendants and still declines to boil them in oil as Costas' long waking nightmare continues.
Send us your comments, questions, and thoughts. Chime in at atolianarchives.tumblr.com.
Be blessed in your endeavors.
Thank you for listening.